History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The Civil War left much of the South in devastation and complete ruin, and after this period, America tried to rebuild itself. This era was known as Reconstruction, and it lasted from 1865 to 1877, but for the emancipated slaves who tried to build a brand new life for themselves, the struggle went on for decades and decades. Many hoped at the beginning that the South would peacefully re-enter the Union, slaves would enjoy full legal liberty as American citizens, and the U.S. would emerge stronger. But this wasn't the case. After thousands of slaves were emancipated, many were kicked off their plantation, they were not allowed any sort of help or assistance, they were refugees, and many times arrested on charges of vagrancy. Others died of disease and starvation. While radical Republicans sought citizenship and full legal equality of Black Americans, white Southerners sought segregation and white supremacy. But despite these challenges, many Black slaves did incredible things. They started businesses, they started schools that eventually became universities. Today's guest, Kidada Williams, who's a historian and author, dives into these stories in the period of Reconstruction. She's an associate professor of history at Wayne State University and host of the new show, Seizing Freedom. She uses firsthand accounts from diaries, newspapers, speeches, and letters to look at the failures and successes of the Reconstruction era told by those who made it happen. So we get into all of these different stories, but we also look at big picture questions of, could the Reconstruction era have been done better? In the 19th century, other nations and empires around the world were dealing with the issues of ending slavery and what to do with those who were both former slaves and those who owned slaves and from an economic perspective, lost a lot of their capital. Do you pay a massive indemnity to former slave owners like the British Empire did? Do you cut the losses and not really help anyone out and provide minimal assistance but just hope everything will sort it out like what happened in the United States? What are the advantages and disadvantages and the moral repercussions of different things? And how could this era have been handled correctly? And what are the lessons to apply today to the 21st century? And there are a lot of effects from the period of Reconstruction, not just handled at the national political level, but those on the ground. So things like birthright citizenship were actively advocated for those who were born in the United States as slaves, but believed they had the full entitlement to citizenship because of this and pushed for the 14th Amendment, something that still has strong influence today. There's a lot to get into with this period and a lot of really interesting things that give you a new perspective on this important period in American history. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Kidada Williams. Professor Williams, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I am really interested in getting into this discussion with you because I've talked about Reconstruction on this series before, but I am not a specialist on this topic. You are a specialist on this topic, so I'll have a lot of questions for you. But first off, what drew you to the period of Reconstruction as a historian and as an author?
As a historian, what drew me was the fact that it is this incredible moment that I didn't learn a lot about in K-12 education. And what I learned was very problematic. So it was really limited, really short-sighted, and incredibly problematic, sort of promoting this sort of myth that Reconstruction failed. And it took me a while, especially once I was in graduate school, to really gain access to an accurate, more comprehensive history of the era. And once I sort of got into that, I learned so much more, and I wanted to learn even more and more and more and more, because Reconstruction is this big thing. There are a lot of things going on, and I think that a lot of times what happens with the larger public and sometimes with historians, as we're talking about it, is that we do a big gloss over it. And so it can be really hard for people to understand all of the moving pieces and what's going on, especially when it comes to focusing on African Americans, which is what I do. So instead of just focusing on the fights between Congress and the president, I follow the Black people. And when you follow African Americans through the Civil War and Reconstruction, you get a more complex history. And it's one that I find infinitely fascinating.
Well, and for listeners, I mentioned this in the prologue, but you are a history professor, but 10 times more important, you're a podcaster, and your series, Seizing Freedom, looks at these firsthand accounts. And that's a unique thing in this time period, because slavery has existed since time immemorial, but there's really two times in history. One are the ancient Greeks, and the second are African Americans who went through slavery, where we have a rich corpus of firsthand accounts from those who experienced. Sadly, there's a lot of people that just disappeared in a black hole, and we don't know what happened. So as you are helping students or listeners or whomever else enter into this world of Reconstruction, for our listeners, can you give an overview of this time period and information that you think is salient in this discussion?
I see the period of Civil War and Reconstruction as one of freedom taking by African Americans and freedom making. And what we mean, or what I mean by that, is African Americans did the impossible. You know, the slavocracy and most of the white unionists expected them to just sort of sit still and stay put during the context of the Civil War. They said, this is a white man's war. It doesn't have anything to do with abolishing slavery or anything to do with black people. And African Americans knew better than that. And so they take advantage of the chaos of the war to escape from slavery. Because wherever slavery exists, especially in the Western Hemisphere and especially in North America, war always destabilizes it. Historically, you can date back to the American Revolution, the War of 1812. War always destabilizes slavery. And so that's what happens during the Civil War. And African Americans take advantage of that. They escape from farms and plantations wherever they can. And if they can escape, then they fight a war for freedom where they are, on farms and plantations, against the people who are continuing to hold them in bondage. And so freedom isn't something that is given to African Americans. It has to be taken. If it was going to be given, the sort of nation could have abolished slavery before the war or without having to go to war. That's not what happened. And going into the war, neither side is believing that emancipation is going to be the end result. African Americans play a role in making sure that that's what happens. And so freedom is taken during the war, and it is buttressed by U.S. policy in the context of the war, and eventually abolished by the time the war is over. But after that, what you have is this belief by the larger white population that slavery was only about being paid for your labor. And so after slavery is abolished, you know, the white population says, you know, okay, we abolished slavery. You'll be paid for your labor. That's it. And African Americans, both those who were still enslaved when the war began and those who had been born free or gained their freedom generations earlier, knew that slavery was about so much more than that, so much more than that. And they insisted on, African Americans insist on, the same rights and privileges and protections that the larger white population takes for granted. And so for them, it means everything that white people were able to enjoy. It means right to family. It means right to education. It means the right to move about freely. It means the right to marry. It means the right to vote and serve in office. So it means all of these things. But many people throughout the nation don't believe that that's what it should mean. But you've got these sort of radical Republicans, these members of Congress who are very progressive, who believe that justice is what's needed after slavery. And part of what that means is acknowledging these rights and protections that African Americans are asking for, demanding. And so that's the sort of freedom making. African Americans play a critical role in making freedom and expanding American freedom and protections, not just for themselves, but for other Americans too.
Can you describe, let's say, right after emancipation, right after the Civil War ends in the South, what was it like in those early days? Because there's a passage in, I think it's Booker T. Washington's autobiography, where he describes all of the celebration that's happening with emancipation. People are singing the night before, and then a Union officer arrives at a plantation and reads the Emancipation Proclamation. But then there's a haunting sense of, well, where on earth do we go from here? Our entire social order has been destroyed. And I could just imagine the South in the days and months afterwards, where this is an entire social order, social system, and when it exists, what do you replace it with? We are making things up as we go along. And what was it like in those early days?
So it was absolute chaos. So they are making things up as they go along, but the former slavocracy and the people who were not members of the slaveholding class, but who expected to become if the Confederacy had been victorious. They, on the one hand, slavery has been destroyed, but they have their mind set on essentially resurrecting slavery or maintaining slavery as much as they can in every way possible. So that's where their minds are. For African Americans, they know who these people are, the people who formerly held them in bondage, the people who want to continue slavery, the people who want to only recognize their right to be paid for their labor and nothing else, and sometimes not even that. So African Americans know who their sort of enemies are, and they're going to have to try to figure out how to coexist with them. But what they also want to do is to start making freedom real. So they, you know, they want the right to move about. They want to gain access to their family. So one of the first things we know people do is make a beeline for kin. They are going along the slave trade routes, reversing paths, you know, from the Underground Railroad, trying to find their people. But while they do that, they also have to do things like work in order to get from one location to the next. They have to work in order to feed themselves, to find shelter, etc. So you've got all of this going on. And even as they try to do that, they're encountering members of the slaveocracy who are determined to not let them do any of that. So it's a really chaotic moment, and it's a really hard moment for a lot of people, because for some of the former slaveholders, one of the first things they do is turn people out. Eject people from the farms and plantations. They say, if you won't accept my right to continue to rule over you, I'm going to kick you out. And so they will kick them out and they'll turn them off. They'll essentially render them homeless. And then they start to enact these policies that make it difficult for them to get jobs or find secure housing, right? And so it's a period of struggle. And former slaves, you know, people who are interviewed in the 1930s, they call this era like a period of hard struggle. And some people don't make it. But it's a struggle largely because it's such a huge endeavor. And because the former slaveocracy, those former slaveholders and the wannabe slaveholders are so determined to keep the system in place despite losing the war. So it's this really hard time period. And what former slaves always say is that they prefer the hard struggle to slavery.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think there was a quote, I don't know who originally said it, but one historian mentioned this line that I could live on basically freedom and air. The quote by some former slaves that with freedom, I mean, I'll take this despite this period of horrific hardship. Well, one follow-up too with former slaves who were ejected by their plantations. And when you mentioned the system of slaveocracy, I have large gaps in my mind of the system. I know sharecropping, but obviously it doesn't switch just from slavery, emancipation, then sharecropping the next day over. This is a whole long process. What did those who were trying to implement the system of slaveocracy hope for? That, well, we're going to create up this underground system of slavery, or we'll give lip service to the Emancipation Proclamation, but we're going to erect this legal order so it's slavery in all but name only and essentially return to the good old days. Is that what they're trying to do or something else?
That's exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to not skip a beat, right, from slavery to freedom. And there are only so many sort of stop gaps along the way, because many of the unionists essentially assume that they're going to accept defeat, the terms of the peace, and move forward. But that's not what happens. And then you also have many white unionists across the country who want to get the economy back on track. So for a lot of people, there's a willingness to accept what the former slaveocracy wants going forward because it's profitable. It allows them to recover quickly from the war and then move on, right? And these are people who also believe that Black people are inferior and that they are best controlled by the former slaveocracy. And so you have a lot of incentive around the country to essentially let the South do whatever they want, if that makes sense. And so, that you know, they get started resurrecting that system or rebuilding that system fairly quickly, like with things like Black codes. So, you know, what's interesting is that some of the Black codes take their old slave codes and remove the word slave and just put the word Negro, right, or colored or something like that. So they don't intend on skipping a beat. And those codes regulate, you know, African Americans' lives from cradle to grave. So they have no real intentions of changing. And it'll take the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the 14th Amendment, and the 15th Amendment to try to establish some kind of change, because the former slavocracy has no intentions of changing.
Well, the name of your show is Seizing Freedom, and you get into character studies of different people, because as you said, in the beginning, when some are ejected from plantations, I imagine it would have looked like a refugee situation, essentially, of people coming out of Syria, or a modern example. But at the same time, I mean, there are shocking stories in a good way. For example, I think what became Alabama State University was essentially started by six former slaves in 1867. I don't know how you do that, but people are doing things like they're starting proto-universities and doing incredible things. So could you describe some of these profiles that you get into of people who survive in this period?
So one of the things that we know is that no one has spent more time thinking about American freedom than the people denied it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for enslaved people, they have spent their entire lives thinking and dreaming about what they will do when freedom comes and what freedom means. So they're outside the circle of freedom, but they're looking inside of it. And many people are dreaming and thinking about and imagining new worlds. And so when the war comes, and then when slavery is abolished, they get busy doing the things that they've been dreaming about doing. So that means reconnecting with kin. That means gaining access to education. That means having a sort of thinking about how to make a living outside of working on a farm or a plantation. What if you want to become a doctor or a lawyer? You know, what if you have been a healer in slavery? After slavery is abolished, you want to become a formal recognized doctor, and you may want to be trained in order to do that. And so what we see them do, so part of that sort of making freedom is the sort of getting busy and participating in those billion tiny acts that make freedom real. And so we've got stories in the show of people who relocate with kin, people who get married, people who gain access to education, people who start to turn their dreams of freedom and making a living doing things that they want to do as opposed to what the slavocracy says they can do, turning those dreams into a reality. And so the beauty of, and this is one of the things that sort of drew me to this period as a historian and that inspires many of my students, is to see all of the possibility. And African Americans playing an active role in that, their agency in trying to assert control over their freedom, and the push and pull. Because the other story we tell in the show is that freedom isn't something that is sort of seized once and is done. It has to be constantly seized and remade. That fight is continuing because there are a lot of people in the country who actually don't want that to happen. So what we see is that they're going to have to fight against white missionaries from the North who have very narrow ideas of what things like education should look like. Essentially, it should prepare them, that it should allow them to read the Bible, and it should prepare them to continue working, you know, on farms and plantations. But African Americans have a bigger vision of freedom than that. And so there's going to be that push-pull, you know, how much do they abide by or play into the system in order to get the scraps that they need out of it, versus sort of seizing and standing their ground and saying, this is what we really want to do and why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love for you to explain how emancipated slaves, former slaves, African-Americans are building institutions, because on one hand, okay, you have access to some of these patronage networks. They could be Northern abolitionists. And there's a long tradition in, let's say, Protestant America of patronage and education and other things to non-whites. This could take the guise of Protestant missionaries that go overseas to the Middle East and other places, to Africa. And there's a religious conversion process, but there's also a civilization process of your dress. So if you have a pretty strict educational model that follows this pretty standard Western curriculum, there are boarding schools to American Indians, and there's the phrase, kill the Indian, save the man, that you educate them, you get them to speak English, you do all these different things. So there's, as African-American, you have this patronage, but like you said, it comes with, well, let's say some strings attached on what how you do cultural expression. So I would imagine others would, maybe some would think, okay, well, do we just do things completely on our own? but then you don't have access to capital. So it's just very tricky balance. So how did people navigate this in the early days? Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
So one of the ways that people navigated is now that they're free, they've got access to the fruits of their labor. So Black people are working, right? And, you know, the slaveocracy said, you know, we can't free them because they'll die without us, right? All of the lies they spin about why slavery should continue. And African Americans, as free people, worked harder for themselves and for their families than they did for the slaveocracy. And so they are using, they are pooling their resources to build. We know some of the first schools. So there are schools that are set up in camps by missionaries, but there are also schools that are set up in communities by former slaves who pool their resources to hire teachers, to buy building material, to build a school, to buy school supplies, to keep the schools heated, etc. So they're using their own money in order to do this. They're doing things like building churches. And so one of the tensions that you have is not only with white missionaries from the North, but Black people who were free before the war. So they have their own ideas, many of them often similar to what the white missionaries from the North want. They have their own ideas for what newly freed people should be doing. And so newly freed people often buck against it. They fight against it and say, you know, we know what you do at your highfalutin church, but that's not what we want at this church. And they're willing to pull their resources together in order to maintain some degree of control over it. So I think we can't lose sight of the fact that as free people, they are now free to be paid for their labor. And they're willing to put as much work and money into institution building as possible. But if that's not enough, they may need to try to rely on the larger patronage system, but then they recognize the tension. And so, and they have to deal with the trade-offs, absolutely.
And right, America has a long, proud history of getting grants from people, but then really running off and doing your own thing. Academics, that's what we do well. So it's a, you know, something we try to keep going on as long as we can. Well, a lot of your show, it's based on firsthand accounts from people. And was there anything that you read, whether newspapers or speeches or diaries, that stuck out to you or surprised you, even after all this time that you've been studying this area?
I think that one of the things that didn't surprise me, but it's one of those moments where you're just sort of like, be still my heart, you know? It's the families that are reconnecting. It's the care that newly freed people put into their marriage ceremonies, right? You know, they're denied the right to have legal recognition of their marriages during slavery, but as free people, they do things like, you know, they put as much care and thought into their wedding ceremony and what they're going to wear, et cetera, and what kind of food they're going to have there as people do today. And it shouldn't be surprising because they're human. They do things that humans do. But it's one of those things that sort of underscores how important this moment was for them and how they marked the differences between slavery and freedom. So that's just one case. There are many cases that we tell, a lot of stories that we tell include moments like that, moments like African-Americans asserting their right to freedom. So when we talk about the Memphis riots, one of the things that we do is, and these are the Memphis riots of 1866, we tell a story beforehand, before we get to the riots, about the Virginia Black hucksters. And these are essentially Black organizers who are trying to stop the city from taxing them, exploiting them through a tax. And so they have organized and they have their petitions and they're essentially saying, we need an end to this tax because we want a right to make a living without this burden. So seeing those kinds of moments, I think, is not surprising to me as a historian, but it's sort of like affirming, like, yes, these are all of the things that we miss, I believe, about the era when we focus only on the fights between Congress and the president.
Mm-hmm. Right, because it's not on the ground. It's not the people themselves who are negotiating things constantly throughout, not just as a one-off thing until this legislation is passed, but as a continual experience.
Right. And then even afterwards, you have to implement it. You have to sort of, you know, go and continue to fight to make sure that, you know, your right to do these things is recognized and protected.
Mm-hmm. This just popped into my mind, but I think it was a newspaper article I was reading one time. It was talking about the experience of the Black church, that institutionally it's the oldest in the Black community of the United States because it predates emancipation, and it was venue in which the Black population had total autonomy, you know, as much as they could hope for, as opposed to other institutions. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, or if that's just a point that somebody was making as conjecture, but not really backed up by the historical record. But in this time period, what do you think are the key institutions that are the bedrock of the Black community? I mean, it could be the church or it could be other things. What do you think is the case?
I think historians agree that it's the main one is family. So like family as an institution and family as, you know, and even in the context of slavery, the fact that enslaved people made family, even within the chaos and even with the dehumanizing treatment in bondage and not recognition, you know, the sort of failure or refusal to recognize their right to family ties, the fact that they make family and make family as they see it needs to be made is incredibly significant. So many historians would say that the family is the most important institution, the oldest institution amongst African Americans. And they don't enjoy complete control, but we see them constantly fighting for control over their families. And so that's one institution. The churches are another institution. And, you know, we see the churches, the former churches, the formal churches in free Black communities, but there is also the that sort of invisible church that exists in slavery, where people are practicing their faith in ways that make sense to them outside of the view of the slaveocracy. So they do retain, and you know, it is there where they can identify the stories in the Bible and the parts of the faith that make sense to them, that help them understand the world, that help them imagine a future.
I want to, there's something else. Yeah, absolutely. Well, when you were thinking of that, there was a book that came out, I think about 10 or 15 years ago, called American Prophet, that said that it made the argument that Moses is sort of the prophet of the Old Testament in which America had latched onto and symbolized American identity. On the one hand, the framers, the founding fathers would see him as the person who talks about liberation. But then on the other hand, former slaves would see him as emancipating a large group of people out of slavery into the promised land. So the rhetoric out of the promised land. Now, I should admit, I didn't read this book. I'm just quoting on what I read by a blurb. So that's how I handle a lot of books. I remember what I read on either a summary or, I'll be honest, mostly on a 4-page review on JSTOR, because who has time to read a book these days? Come on. So I want to get back to that, but I want to telescope out for a moment on something we were discussing off air before the interview started. What I always like about the show is to talk with historians about large meta historical issues. And what I wonder is, with the period of Reconstruction, is there a way that it could have been done right? Because the United States is not the only nation that's dealing with this. Slavery was a universal institution in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Various nations and empires are dealing with the issues of emancipation, and other people are doing it very differently. For example, the British Empire abolished slavery in 1835. However, they paid an indemnity, not to the former slaves, but to the slave owners, that was massive. It was like 20% of the GDP. And Britain only ended paying back that with the treasury, I think, in 2015 or something. So some would say, well, look, they managed to avoid a civil war. Granted, the money didn't go to the slaves, but you don't have the vindictiveness of former slave owners who, if we're talking in purely economic terms, didn't lose their capital. So you don't have Jim Crow laws and KKK and set up. That's the argument. I'm not saying I agree with it. So I don't know. Would the right way have been, okay, you pay an indemnity to former slaves, you give them some plot of land for slave owners. Yes, they were involved in an immoral institution, but at the time, the government sanctioned it, so they were participating economically in something the government sanctioned. So you get them out of this purely as an economic means to avoid the vindictiveness, but that could lead to a war. Complicated thing. So how do you think, could Reconstruction have been done right, do you think?
So I think it could have been, but I also think that we have to acknowledge that for the slaveocracy, it's not just about the money. It's about power. It's about domination. And so there was no amount of money they were going to take to give that up. And so, and then you also have to contend with the fact that where's the money going to come from, right? Are unionists going to allow themselves to be taxed for a system that they also rely quite heavily on? So where's this money going to come from, right? Who's going to pay it? And what amount would the slaveocracy take? And, you know, given what we know about them, given what we know about their desire to destabilize governments in Central and South America in order to extend U.S. slavery there, I don't know that there was any dollar amount that they would have accepted. And I think that unionists knew that too, right? So you've got a lot of technical things you've got to figure out with that. And but one of the things that they do, I think that part of what they try to do in making and doing Reconstruction right is abolishing slavery, passing the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, and the Civil Rights of 1875, the Civil Rights Act of 1875. So they try to do everything right. What they don't count on is the opposition of members of the former slaveocracy and large numbers of white Americans who only accepted emancipation in order to win and end the war. Those people aren't exactly, those people don't embrace the idea of a multiracial democracy. They don't really believe in freedom and liberty and justice for all. They only really believe in it for white people. And so I think one of the tensions that we've got to sort of address is the reality of white supremacy and how that made it more difficult to have the freedoms and protections and doing Reconstruction right, how that's undermined by white supremacy. And it's not that you don't have that reality in the Caribbean, because you do, but you've got very different conditions there, demographic conditions, histories, etc. In the United States, once they realize they're not going to be able to repatriate large numbers of Black people somewhere else, which is what we know, even Abraham Lincoln is pursuing through the war, even after the Emancipation Proclamation, he is still toying with and trying to figure out what can we do to get them all to leave the country. But they realize that that's probably going to be more expensive than they want to have to deal with. And then you have to do it by force. Because the vast majority of African Americans are saying, we're not leaving. So they have to sort of work out those realities. And I think that they do some of the best that they could do. And I think they do it better than other places in the Western Hemisphere that had slavery. What they didn't address was the reality of white supremacy and the vast majority of white Americans' commitment to it and how that erodes the moral compass. And so it erodes the moral compass, and it allows for the rest of the nation to essentially turn its back on former slaves, on the rights and protections that were spelled out for them with the civil rights legislation and the Reconstruction Amendments, and then essentially allow the former slaveocracy to get back to doing what it had been doing before. So to do Reconstruction right would have been to address a reality that the United States didn't want to at the time, which is the horrors of white supremacy. Or they prioritize a commitment to white supremacy over during Reconstruction, right? Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. I was thinking, there was another guest I had on the show a few months ago who talked about the different types of civic nationalism in America, sort of what is a collective consciousness of America? And there was never one definition, but there's different things. There was the frontier thesis, popular in the 1890s, in the antebellum period, there was an argument that it was a white nationalism, very popular in the South, but then had a renaissance in the early 20th century with Woodrow Wilson and the Klan and other people. And then others like Frederick Douglass are arguing that it is a period of, it's a spirit of the constitutional nationalism that isn't dependent on race. So there's people trying to push back on it. But like, as you said, this is something that's vibrant in people's minds. And those who believed in it as a matter, not just of economics, but of power, of being slaveholders, there was sort of a neo-feudal order in the South. So people are leaving America and going to places like Brazil after the Civil War so they can still have slavery and willing to die of diseases in inland Brazil. And there's the town of Americano that's still there today.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think we also have to acknowledge that the same mindset is a national mindset. it is not just one in the South. It's why a state like Ohio, excuse me, not Ohio, no, you know, no slander in Ohio, like Oregon, would explicitly ban Black people from moving there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because their belief that it's a white state, you know? And so that is not something that is limited to the South, and that predates the Civil War. And it continues after the Civil War. One of the other things that we have is that after slavery is destroyed, you're going to have white people migrating out of the South, just like you have Black people migrating out of the South. And they're going to carry their beliefs and histories and commitments with them to those new communities. And they're going to sort of form strong bonds that are about retaining or protecting American freedom and democracy for white people with other white people, so, and even new immigrants that are coming into the country. And so that's going to be this sort of tension. And that's why I said we can't lose sight of the ways that white supremacy erodes not only the moral compass, but the sort of ideas of American freedom for all.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'd like to look at this particular generation, the generation of Reconstruction, because when we're learning about emancipation and then later the Civil Rights Movement, which is a jump of a century, when I'm thinking of what I learned in my K-12 education, I learned, okay, there's the Emancipation Proclamation, then there's Reconstruction that leads to the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, the establishment of the Jim Crow order. Then there are things that cause small cracks in the facade of this, such as soldiers, Black soldiers in World War I, much more in World War II. Then you have Jackie Robinson. Then you have arts and entertainment in the 1950s. Then you have the Freedom Riders, culminating the Civil Rights Movement. And those are some of the main points in this 100-year period. But I think what it leaves out and what you're highlighting here is that the people who are emancipated, they're not just marking time. They're not just suffering. I mean, yes, they're suffering, but they're working on building out liberty for themselves and for their descendants as well. So how would you characterize this generation? And what do you think they did from the end of the Civil War up to, you know, their 20 or 30 years when they're the most active to really move things forward and make things better for their descendants, but not just their descendants, but really for all Americans, because their story is a story for all of us to look up to and be inspired by. Hey, everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
So I think one of the things they did first off was to push for birthright citizenship. And this would be the Blacks who were free before the war ended. And they faced their own restrictions in terms of rights and privileges and freedoms before the Civil War. So they're going to be part of the people who are going to push for what will become the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which is going to be a precursor for the 14th Amendment. And that is really essentially about establishing citizenship rights and protections that know no difference in terms of race or class, that know no difference in terms of race or previous condition of servitude. And so when they establish that, that's going to have rights and protections for all Americans in the period coming forward. When they establish birthright citizenship, that impacts not only African Americans, but the children and grandchildren of immigrants up until this very day. We get that because African Americans built that out, insisted. Martin Delaney insists before the Civil War. Frederick Douglass insists before the war that Black people have a right to citizenship by virtue of their birth here. So they're making that argument before the war even begins. And after the war, we see them build that out. The rights and protections in terms of equal protection under the law, the right to national due process, the right to national equal protection under the law. If your states don't uphold or protect your rights, then the federal government is supposed to step in. The 14th Amendment to this day is one of the most litigated issues in American law. And so African Americans played a role in building that out. So they do that for the larger nation, expanding more freedom and protections to more Americans by voting, access to public accommodations, etc. So they do all of that. But for their children, one of the things that they do, and it's very clear when you think about some of the greats of the early 20th century, Paul Robeson, Ida B. Wells Barnett, their parents and grandparents were slaves, and they instill in them a sense of responsibility and commitment to expanding freedom and protecting freedom, not only for themselves, but for everyone around them. And so there is this, you know, when I look at that generation that comes of age, those people we call new Negroes in the early part of the 20th century, they are the children and grandchildren of slaves. And if you think about all of the impressive things that they do, people like Booker T. Washington even, they don't get that from nowhere. They get that from their people, that sense of building a better world for themselves and making the nation, helping the nation, but sometimes making the nation live up to its promises. And that's one of the things we're going to see that members of the civil rights era are going to build upon. Most of civil rights advancements always go back to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Every single one of them. Voting rights, access to places of public accommodation, access to schools, desegregation, all of it goes back to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. And that's what the NAACP is litigating throughout all of this time period. So when they talk about the nation's violation, they're saying, you know, segregation isn't just something that's inconvenient and problematic, although it's that. It's a violation of the U.S. Constitution. It's a violation of the 13th, 14th Amendment. Disfranchisement is a violation of the letter and the spirit of the 15th Amendment. So essentially what they do is they make the nation hold up or honor the promise. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. says, we want what you put on paper. We're not asking for anything new. We want what's already there. And African Americans during the Reconstruction era, they didn't say the exact same thing, but they meant it. We want what you put on paper. And for them, it wasn't the original Constitution. It was the Declaration of Independence that they always cited, that they always held up to the nation as a mirror and said, these are the rights and protections that we believe that all Americans should enjoy. You don't say in the Declaration that only white men enjoy this. So we believe everyone should. And so their knowledge of that, their commitment to that, their refusal to accept anything less is one of the things that the Freedom Generation passes on to its children and grandchildren.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, something like that birthright citizenship, that doesn't just happen. Two of my children were born abroad, one in Europe, one in Hungary specifically, and the other in Turkey. And people ask me, oh, are they Hungarian or Turkish citizens? And I say, nope. Like, whoa, why not? They were born there. Doesn't mean anything because you have to establish all these different things. It's based more on ethnic ties. So if they were ethnically Hungarian but born in Romania, then they would get Hungarian citizenship. So there you go. Things like that don't just happen. It takes the will of a group of people to make that happen, like you described with the Freedom Generation. Well, to close us off, something that I like about history and what I try to do with this podcast is look at stories from the past as really a grand laboratory of human experience, that whatever we're facing individually or facing as a society, we can see examples in the past of those who either did things very well, and those are stories to inspire us today, or those who made a horrible mistake, and those are pitfalls to avoid today. And with your series, what do you hope are the lessons that we can heed today?
I think that with Seizing Freedom, what we hope that the listeners will understand is the very fact that freedom is something that has to be seized and it has to be protected. And so we hope that seeing the process of seizing freedom and trying to maintain freedom and trying to protect and preserve freedom is an ongoing process. And it's an ongoing process because there are people who are opposed to other people enjoying the same rights and freedoms and protections as they do. So what I hope is that in seeing this history and seeing where we went wrong, that it will fortify Americans who really believe in freedom today to shoulder their responsibility for protecting freedom and American democracy for all.
Right. And I'm sure there's a lot more there to unpack with your show. And for listeners who want to learn more about it and find it online, where is the best place to go?
So the best place to go is seizingfreedom.com.
All right. Yeah. Nice and easy. And I'm sure people can find it there in any podcast player of their choice. So Professor Williams, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Suma 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group. And here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.